This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
This lecture tonight is entitled, Shouldn't the Christian Faith Be Easier? And this is something that often happens. As we start to prepare lectures, we realize that we're actually preparing more than one lecture, and so it ends up snowballing a little bit. And so I've decided to call this lecture part one, coming to believe. It may be part one of a one-part series, I don't know, but it might be more. We will see, but I'm not going to commit to that yet. Yeah, and the reason why it's snowballed into potentially more than one lecture is that the question, shouldn't Christianity be easier than it is, can mean so many different things for so many different people. It can be asked from many, many different perspectives. And I had sort of an idea of what I meant by that question, but as I sat down to write the lecture and to think it through, I realized that can mean lots and lots of things. And each perspective on that question is important in its own way. So if you just think with me for a few minutes, there's a question of our own struggles with sin, if we are Christian. If God is real and he wants me to have victory over that brokenness in my life, shouldn't it be easier than it is to actually conquer those things? There's a question of church. If it's so important to be a member of a body and God is real and he's there and he cares, shouldn't it be easier than it is to find and stick with a church? We're not going to actually follow any of these down there. These are all huge topics, obviously. There's the question of spiritual experience. If God is really with me, why does he feel so distant? There's questions about the social costs of following Christ. Why, if God is real and wants me to share the truth of the gospel with people, do so many people think I'm crazy or stupid or immoral for being a Christian? Right? Shouldn't that be easier? And then there's just a million different questions about obedience and love and forgiveness and service, all the types of things that God calls us to in the Christian life. Why are each of these so challenging and hard if God is real and wants us to live that way? Why? And so these are all questions about the challenges of living the Christian life, and I think that most Christians on some level or another engage with these questions to a degree at least. One thing that I was noticing is that they sort of bear a resemblance to the question of the problem of evil, in a sense. The problem of evil being this well-treaded philosophical question about how can there be a God who is good, who is powerful, and still there's evil in the world. And that question has been discussed for a long, 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 long time. And many people conclude that since there is undeniably evil in the world, then there must not be a God that is good and powerful. He's either well-meaning and weak, or powerful and a sadist, or he just doesn't exist. And so the questions that I've just been raising a few minutes ago, they bear a resemblance to that, but they're more personal and practical and less abstract and philosophical than that, I think. I call it the problem of difficulty. It's the problem of difficulty, and what they share with the problem of evil is the word if. I intentionally inserted the word if in all of those questions. I don't know if anybody noticed, but the word if is loaded, and it's interesting and troubling. If God is really there, and if the Christian faith is really true, shouldn't the Christian life be easier? Because the word "if," the reason it's troubling to me and fascinating is that it implies that the truth of the Christian faith and perhaps even God's existence is hanging in the balance, depending on whether I find it easy to live out or hard to live out. And I think this is a quiet kind of assumption. It's not often, we don't often proclaim this from the rooftops, but it's sort of a quiet attitude behind the questions. The Christian life has always been a difficult thing to live out, and it's at times and places been a dangerous thing to live out. Jesus tells people to count the cost. Not a good evangelistic strategy. Count the cost before following me. Prepare to deny yourself. Prepare to potentially lose your family and your friends. I think we can assume that some people did count the cost and found it too costly. So this is, in one sense, not a brand new thing. But this assumption that the ease of living out a worldview is an indication of whether that worldview is true to reality. There's something different going on there, and I'm basically this lecture is me trying to put my finger on what's going on. It seems to me that this is more of a recent occurrence. It's not the same thing as just counting the cost and saying, you know what, to follow Jesus, I don't think I can do that. It's taking the difficulty of living out a particular belief, and if that just seems really too difficult to me, then maybe that belief isn't true. And that's a different sort of thing. It's a subtle thing for many people, I think, but it's ease as an indicator of truth. And of course, the inverse is difficulty, I think, for many people has become a sign that perhaps truth lies elsewhere. This is actually, this idea is kind of leapfrogging off of something my colleague Sarah lectured on a while back on creative work, on creating art and kind of trying to deflate the romanticism of art creating. It really is work. Creative work is work. It's not sitting around on a cloud waiting for inspiration or whatever. And one of the phenomenon that you raised, Sarah, is this idea that ease determines right. You know, if it comes easily, this must be the right sort of thing for me to do in my creative work. Rather than allowing ourselves to be guided by some other standard, which might mean being called to quite difficult things. Anyway, that's the same sort of idea, but it's ease as an indicator of truth, and difficulty as an indicator of untruth. And so my outline, I don't have a screen for you tonight or a handout, but I'm going to give you a rough idea of my outline anyway if you want to take it down in notes or something like that. But the first section is just dealing with what is this question exactly? Is Christianity too hard to believe? Second section will be a long and sort of scattered list of problems that I see with the question. And then the third section will be what are some perspectives that we can bring from biblical teaching on this question. What does the Bible say about the ease of belief? Or not say about the ease of belief. So, first section, is Christianity too hard to believe? I want to focus really on one version of this question for tonight, and that has to do with, in a sense, with conversion itself, coming to belief, becoming convinced that the Christian faith is true. And then once someone is convinced of it, maintaining that belief, remaining a believing person. Why isn't Christianity easier to believe? Why is it so hard to come to a place of real belief if it's really true? And I think one of the ways in which we hear this question is from people who are skeptical about religious truth in general, sometimes even in a way that's meant to discredit belief in the Christian faith as something that people believe with zero evidence to support it, something for people who are gullible or willfully ignorant. Right? So if this God was real and what the Bible said was really true, there would be some actual evidence for it, right? I mean, and since there is none, it's there's no real supportable reason to believe. And I think this is a version of the question, obviously coming from a place of unbelief. If Christianity was true, it would be more obviously true to more people. It would be more self-evident, you could say, than it is. Now, another totally different version of the same question, I think, and this is, you're beginning to see why I was floundering preparing this lecture. I've heard many Christians ask very similar question, which is from a place of belief, but from a place of struggle and doubt, right? I believe, but I need reassurance that this is still true. I've been disappointed. Maybe I've been disillusioned. Maybe I feel that for whatever reason I've lost touch with God. You can. Many of you have probably heard this or even thought this, but it just doesn't feel real to me anymore. I have doubts that are growing. I have unaddressed questions, lingering fears that maybe this is just one big made-up story. Or perhaps it's a result of having some sin that I just cannot break free of, and I'm not sure that God is much help. I'm not sure that God is really either there or committed to helping me through something. So why is it so difficult to keep on believing? Why is it such a battle? Maybe early in our lives or early in our faith, it was easier to believe. Something seemed to come more naturally. But why doesn't God continue to give me that kind of assurance in my life of His presence and of His reality? I'm not trying to say everybody experiences this. I think many people actually really do, thank the Lord, grow in their faith, grow in maturity, grow in their in how convinced they are of God's reality. So I'm not trying to say this is a universal perspective at all, but it's something that certainly working in Libri, I've sort of heard in various different forms quite a lot. The image of, you know, if the Christian life is like a sheer cliff face, you know, if you think of that film, what's the film that Free Solo, you know, that's terrifying. You know, if the Christian life is a cliff face, you know, we're on it, I believe, but there should be a lot more footholds. It's pretty smooth. And what's going on here? There needs to be something more to go on, God. I've even heard this. I've even asked this myself, too. This is maybe the most sort of ramped up version of the question. God, you are capable of revealing yourself with such power and clarity that I would never doubt you again. Why don't you just do it? Has anyone ever asked that? I don't know if that's... Is that okay? Now, obviously, people are very, very different from each other. And again, this is not everybody's experience. But some of this is certainly autobiographical. I imagine that most, many Christians do struggle with these questions on some level. We believe in God, but we also want a sign from Him so that belief would become easier and would come more naturally. I think that's what it is. And there is a big difference here. Again, there's a distinction. There's a big difference between crying out to God, why is it so hard? Well, King David is a master at that. I mean, that's all over the Bible. That's not, and God, I don't think, ever condemns that as being somehow wrong theologically or wrong in our attitude to cry out to God, why is it so hard? But there is a difference in making the claim, if this was true, it would be easier. Right? Because that's moving towards this openness to the possibility that because it's hard, maybe it's just all made up. Maybe I'm just on the wrong path altogether. Now, third, that's sort of a believing question. Another question I think that I've spoken to many people who feel this, they ask a similar question as believers, but out of concern for friends and maybe family members that don't believe. Lord, why don't you simply reveal yourself powerfully to this person that I care about, right? So they would just believe, right? How hard could it be for you, God? If it's such a, if it's so vitally important that people come to faith, why don't you make yourself known more clearly? Why don't you? Why do you seem to hide from the people that need to know you? And so there's something good. I'm not going to just poke holes in all these questions. There's something good in each of them. I think there's something good and certainly understandable in each of them. I think the first version I mentioned, which is really from a place of skepticism and unbelief, it actually is good to care about evidence. We should be wary of believing things that are nonsense. It's not just atheists that should care about that. If nothing at all in the world pointed to the truth of the Christian faith, if the Bible had nothing convincing to say about real life, then we shouldn't be Christians. It matters. It does have lots of convincing things to say about real life, and I think, should be the foundation of why we are Christians. The affirmation that the Christian faith is true should be accompanied, I think, by a willingness to question it, to poke it, to prod it. If it really does describe reality, then in seeking reality honestly, we will be coming closer to God. So there's something not altogether corrupt in that way of asking the question. Now, the second one, the question from a place of belief. Why is it, I believe, but why is it so hard? Now, if you are a Christian, there's an understandable desire for a greater confidence in God's reality. Is God's presence just as real to me as the sunshine or a handshake or the ground? You know, no, it's not. I don't experience it as being as real as the physical things I can touch, and yet it is. I believe it is. I believe it's even more real than the things that I can touch and taste and see with my senses. And I want to grow in that awareness of God's reality as being true all the time, even when I'm not thinking about it. the Apostle Paul talks about seeing through a glass darkly. Is it wrong to want to see God face to face? To see him more directly? No. Is it wrong to want to stop wavering in my faith? No. These are good things. And then the third question, the one of, obviously, it's a good thing to care about the salvation of a friend or someone who doesn't know God, to want him to reveal himself to them somehow. So these are all ways in which I think there are legitimate desires at the root of some of these questions. And if there are legitimate desires at the root of these questions, shouldn't belief itself be easier? Doesn't this question have validity? Well, I want to move on to some of the assumptions behind the question, particularly this idea of difficulty indicating untruth. And I want to try to back up quite a lot and get a running start, so to speak. So it'll hopefully become clear why I've backed up as I go. But in addressing the question of truth as a concept, what is truth and how is that word conceived of today? Now, if we allow, just for the sake of argument, that the God of the Bible really does exist, I don't know if everyone in that room agrees with that statement, but if we do, for the sake of our argument, allow that, and we allow that, you know, the God of the Bible is not a figment of our imaginations, it's not a social construct or whatever, it follows that this truth would be unaffected by whether or not I find it plausible, right? If God is real outside of my head, and it's not just something that human beings made up, if he actually has an identity, a real self that's outside of my head, whether or not I find that believable, it doesn't really affect that reality, right? He's still there. The truth stands as the truth, whether or not I come to believe it, whether or not I find it challenging to apprehend. The image I have in my mind often is sometimes I think we're in danger of viewing God as a bad light bulb that sort of flickers on and off. You know, like in a horror movie or something, you go into the old rundown house and there's a light bulb that's can't decide whether it's on or off. You know, and is that really what God is? Depending on our level of belief, in his existence? Does he just flicker into existence and flicker out of existence because I feel like he's there and then I don't feel like he's there? No, that's not a picture of the God of the Bible. Reality is reality, and one of the goals of the Christian life is to bend towards reality, to let reality shape us, and not to sort of foster the attitude that I determine reality outside of my head. So to many people, it sort of goes without saying, to many people today that's an extremely outdated idea of religious truth, because it means that it's possible to be wrong, even very wrong about something that actually matters. And that idea that someone could be wrong about religious truth is kind of a heresy in the sort of relativistic climate that we live in today, in this country at least, in the West. The reason this is such an implausible idea to people today, I think, is that there's this chasm. This is a pathetically simple explanation of sort of post-Enlightenment Western thought, but there's a chasm that's opened up between the measurable things of the natural world, things that we can measure and investigate with science, a chasm between those things and then the invisible things of the quote-unquote supernatural world. The immanent and the transcendent, or the physical and the metaphysical, are no longer of a piece in the way they might have been before. They're no longer of a piece in people's minds today. So it's just one of the most basic assumptions in the West today that arguments over what is true should only take place if we're talking about the physical, measurable facts of the world. It's what Francis Schaeffer called the lower story. He had this concept of two stories that never really interact with each other. The lower story is the area in which you can actually talk about truth. You can say that word and not be penalized. Because you're talking about, you know, what people think of as verifiable facts, things you could discern in the physical world. Now, the realm of the transcendent supernatural ideas, like God's existence, for example, belongs to this upper story, and it's thought to be completely subjective. So it's the realm of infinite relative truths, which means that whether I believe in God is a matter of my preference. If I do believe in God, he is whoever I want him to be. Arguments over religious truth are out of place, and they're very often dismissed as arrogant or dogmatic. To try to convince or persuade someone to take the same view of God that you have is just sort of a nonsense, maybe even an arrogant and hateful thing in many circles today. How could you do that? Because it's so obvious in people's minds that religious truth is a matter for people just to decide what's true for them. Right. What's true for me is not necessarily true for anybody else, and that's just fine. So the upper story is a realm, in other words, in which it's impossible to be wrong. Right? It's also impossible to be right in any universal sense that applies to other people. So the Christian claims about universal truth, things that really apply to everyone, to many people today, that sounds like, or it's akin to saying, Toyotas are right, Hondas are wrong. It's taking something which should be so obviously a matter of preference and saying one is false and one is true. It just doesn't even compute, right? Maybe you have strong ideas of what's better than it. Personally, I would choose Hondas, but that's not, I wouldn't say they were even in any universal sense, right. Despite this, nevertheless, the Bible does present truth as something that is the same for everyone. God is terribly insensitive to idol worshippers throughout the Bible. It's, you know, what we choose to worship is not a matter of free, open preference. There's getting it right and there's getting it wrong. Interestingly, there's a repeated line in Psalm 14 and then for some reason in Psalm 53 too. Exactly the same line, and it says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." I think this is a fascinating, just very, very concise and challenging thing to look at. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. The fool might be following his heart, which today is all you need, right? If you're following your heart, then you're right. You know? Well, the fool might be following his heart, but his heart might be completely dead wrong. And in fact, biblically speaking, the way he can stop being a fool is for his heart to get in line with reality. So this is just sort of getting at this from the outset. We have to question one of the assumptions behind the question of the evening. According to the Bible's understanding of truth, the ease with which I can accept some idea is not necessarily an accurate indication that it is true. If there's any such thing as truth at all in the biblical sense, I have to allow for the possibility that it could be difficult to grasp, difficult to apprehend, hard to accept, and yet still be true. That's at least theoretically possible, right? That's the first of maybe most foundational like question or challenge to the question that I can see. There's another problem with the question, I think, and that is if Christianity is true, why isn't it easier to believe? It should be easier. And the assumption that is problematic here is that we can ask that question as if where I happen to be standing myself is irrelevant to what I conclude about God. My attitudes, my biases, my desires, my life experiences play no part in what I find plausible. If I can't bring myself to believe in God, it's because He has not done enough to make Himself known. Or maybe He's just not there. We often have an image of ourselves as waiting patiently and objectively and openly for God to get with the program and do His part, right? I can ask the question, shouldn't belief be easier as if I had done all I can do to honestly seek the truth and now the ball is in God's court, so to speak, right? And I think this self-image is a naive one. I think if we actually made the effort to articulate that that's what we were doing, we'd often see how naive it is. No matter who we are, regardless of whether we're asking that question as a Christian or not a Christian, none of us stands in a place of total neutrality when it comes to believing in God. I could conceive of standing in a place of neutrality when it comes to judging whether a Honda or a Toyota is a better car. But the question of God's existence is way too loaded with implications for people for us to be neutral about it. It's not an interesting bit of trivia that we could add to our bank of knowledge in some sort of disinterested way. It's something that if we accept it, it will make radical demands of us. It'll demand submission, obedience. It'll involve acknowledging that I'm not my own and I didn't create myself and I don't get to create myself. It will involve acknowledging that I'm not actually the boss of my life, and I might want to be quite badly. It will involve acknowledging that I'm actually dependent in a way that I don't like to think of myself as being. It will involve acknowledging that I've been wrong, and I need forgiveness. And this is a hard thing to admit. What if I like my reputation as being an irreverent person or a sophisticated agnostic person? What if I'm really attached to that self-image? What if my friends view me as someone who would never fall for something so conventional as organized religion? You can come up with as many different examples as you want. Like, what if that's how I feel as I'm coming to this question? Is God real? Is the God of the Bible real? What if turning to God would require me to let go of resentment that I would rather not let go of? You can see there's in each one of these misgivings or things that make us reluctant to actually accept the truth of the Christian faith, each one of these misgivings are significant obstacles between me and Jesus. But none of them have to do with evidence for His reality. They have to do with my will, they have to do with my desires, they have to do with my imagination, they have to do with my self-image. what I find appealing and cool. They have to do with my upbringing and life experiences, maybe. But people reject the truth all the time, not for lack of evidence, but because they have too much to lose by acknowledging it as true. It's a costly thing. Now, again, depending on where you're standing and what you have at stake, to some people, acknowledging the truth of the gospel is the best news ever, immediately, and they embrace it, and that's wonderful, and that's the work of the Holy Spirit. But I think many people are in to some degree in this other camp of like, if I become a Christian, it's really going to mean I'm not my own anymore. And it's not a matter of just looking at the facts and objectively weighing evidence. It's a matter of, do I want to do that? Am I prepared to make that step? Essentially relinquishing autonomy. And I think this is an area in which we see the power of self-deception. There's always a temptation for us as sinful people to disbelieve the things that we don't want to be true, while at the same time telling ourselves that we're being objective and fair-minded. And I think most people, part of being a human being after the fall is this capacity for self-deception. We don't just deceive other people. We're very good at convincing ourselves things about us that are not true. We do not always have an earnest desire for the truth, or not as earnest as we think we do. But it's important to think we do. I want to believe that I'm very objective and fair-minded. So even if the truth were easier to see clearly, which is what we're asking, right? Why isn't the truth easier to see clearly? Even if it were, the real question is, would it be any easier for us to accept? Even if we saw it as clear as day, would we accept it? And not necessarily. Wonderful novel. This is the part of the lecture, which is in every lecture where we talk about C.S. Lewis. So I make that joke every time, too. I'm sorry. This is getting old. But his novel, Till We Have Faces, which is a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche. And I don't know how to pronounce the main character's name. Orwell. I should have just picked something and been confident with it. Orwell. So Orwell is the older half-sister of Psyche. And their father is the king of Gloam, which is this ancient kingdom that Lewis invented. Somewhere north of Greece, up in Macedonia somewhere, or something, I don't know. Psyche is very, very beautiful and pure and lovely in every way. And Orwell loves her and basically raises her from the time she's a baby. When there is a terrible famine in the land, Psyche is offered as a sacrifice to the shadow brute. So this is a very sort of dark pagan culture. She's offered as a sacrifice to this creature called the shadow brute, which is supposedly this monstrous son of the goddess of the mountain, which is the goddess that they worship. And the way she's sacrificed is she's just left tied to this remote tree on the mountainside, and the shadow brute is thought to come and take her, consume her. And this is very much meant to bring prosperity back to the land, which is suffering from this famine. So Orwell journeys up the mountain later to retrieve Psyche's bones. She thinks she's going to find Psyche's body. But to her shock and joy, she finds Psyche perfectly healthy and in vigorous health. She's overjoyed, but her joy fades away because Psyche tells her that the son of the goddess is no brute at all, but rather a beautiful god who has taken her as his bride. So even as they speak, Psyche gestures to the palace that is her new home, but Orwell can't see it. And rather than trust that Psyche sees something real which is invisible to her, she begins to doubt her sister's sanity. She thinks something else has happened to explain this. This is all built up to the quote I'm going to read. The next morning at dawn, Orwell wakes up and is preparing to descend the mountain again, confused and angry. She goes to the river to drink. And this is what happens. For when I lifted my head and looked once more into the mist across the water, I saw that which brought my heart into my mouth. There stood the palace, gray, as all things were gray in that hour and place, but solid and motionless, wall within wall, pillar and arch and architrave, acres of it, a labyrinthine beauty. As she had said, it was like no house ever seen in our land or age. Pinnacles and buttresses leaped up. No memories of mine, you would think, could help me to imagine them. Unbelievably tall and slender, pointed and prickly, as if stone were shooting out into branch and flower. No light shone from any window. It was a house asleep. And somewhere within it, asleep also, someone or something, how holy or horrible or beautiful or strange, with Psyche in its arms. And I, what had I done and said? What would it do to me for my blasphemies and unbelievings? I never doubted that I must now cross the river or try to cross it, even if it should drown me. I must lie on the steps at the great gate of that house and make my petition. I must ask forgiveness of Psyche as well as of the god. I had dared to scold her, dared, what is worse, to try to comfort her as a child. But all the time she was far above me, herself now hardly mortal, if what I saw was real. I was in great fear. Perhaps it was not real. I looked and looked to see if it would not fade or change, and then I rose, for all this time I was still kneeling where I had drunk. Almost before I stood on my feet, the whole thing had vanished. There was a tiny space of time in which I thought I could see how some swirlings of mist had looked, for the moment, like towers and walls, but very soon, no likeness at all. I was staring simply into fog, and my eyes smarting with it. Okay, so this is where it gets good. She goes, "And now, you who read, give judgment. That moment, when I either saw or thought I saw the house, does it tell against the gods or against me? Would they, if they answered, make it a part of their defense? Say it was a sign, a hint, beckoning me to answer the riddle one way rather than the other. I'll not grant them that. What is the use of a sign which is itself only another riddle? It might, I'll allow so much, it might have been a true seeing. The cloud over my mortal eyes may have been lifted for a moment. It might not. What would be easier than for one distraught, and not maybe so fully waking as she seemed, gazing at a mist in a half-light, to fancy what had filled her thoughts for so many hours? What easier even than for the gods themselves to send the whole furley for a mockery? Either way, there's divine mockery in it. They set the riddle and then allow a seeming that can't be tested and can only quicken and thicken the tormenting whirlpool of your guesswork. If they had an honest intention to guide us, why is their guidance not plain? Psyche could speak plain when she was three. Do you tell me the gods have not yet come so far?" Anyway, that's just a taste of this amazing, amazing novel. You should read it. So, the main character, Orwell, has been given a vision. She also had the word of her sister, whom she'd never known to lie before, and who actually wasn't really showing any signs of insanity. She seemed to be perfectly in her right mind, except she just saw something that her sister couldn't see. But the very thought that Psyche could belong to someone else is intolerable. The very thought that Psyche could find joy in someone other than her is infuriating. She's desperate to be the only one that Psyche needs. So her fury and her jealousy, her desire to possess her sister forever, prevents her from accepting that what she saw was real. So she tells herself she wants the gods to communicate more clearly, to stop playing around, But really, she's unwilling to listen to them if it means losing Psyche. So she's been given evidence, but she is a master, and the whole book really is sort of this incredible account of how masterfully she discounts evidence. The entire book actually is a complaint against the gods. It's her case against the gods, and in the end of the book, she gets to read it to the gods, and you see what happens. Well, I'm not going to give away that part. Y'all should just. It's your homework assignment for next week. So, similarly, I think, C.S. Lewis is talking about this sort of pre-Christian pagan world, but there's a lot of parallels between her questions about the gods and our interacting with the Lord, the one God. There are many, many obstacles to belief in God, and some of those obstacles are in our own hearts. They're erected by us, they're maintained by us, they're defended by us. and they don't have to do with lack of evidence. And I want to just to move on to that whole question of evidence, because I think it's a really fascinating whole topic when we think about evidence for God's existence, or evidence more broadly for the account of reality the Bible says as being true. Is there evidence for that? An analogy that's been helpful to me, if you think of each one of you, you're a judge in a courtroom. And before the trial begins, you have to decide what evidence is admissible in your courtroom and what is not. This is something that lawyers quibble over. The attorneys for the prosecution and the defense are both arguing for what should be allowed into the courtroom as evidence and what should be stricken and not allowed as evidence. And who do you listen to, and what criteria do you use to choose what is legitimate evidence and what is not? What gets included as useful and relevant and reliable evidence, and what gets excluded? In this analogy, it's not the way real courtrooms work, but in this analogy, whatever you decide to keep becomes what is known as evidence from that point on. So whatever you decide is inadmissible will be removed, and the jury will not legally be allowed to consider it as evidence. They won't even know about it. It'll just be not on the table anymore. So you get to decide before the trial even begins what evidence is admissible and what's not. And this process has already taken place by the time we start to weigh evidence and decide whose story the evidence supports. That's the actual trial, right? We may be very fair and objective in weighing that admissible evidence, but were we as fair and objective earlier when we ruled out certain information as inadmissible? There's some evidence that we discount before we even start to weigh evidence. And I think there's a way in which we do this with God all the time. Even in some ways, believers who actually really do know He's there. I've had conversations with people recently where I wish there were. I believe in God. I believe in God's love as a concept. But I wish there was some evidence that God really loved me in particular. What evidence of God's love have I already ignored as inadmissible? You see, so often what we conclude about God has to do with what we treat as evidence and what we discount. That's not a real sign of God's love. No, that's just whatever. I don't look at that. I have particular criteria for what I define as a way that God could show love to me. And if He doesn't do it in that way, then there's no sign that He cares about me at all. So it's not that God has given no evidence that He's real. Rather, our tendency is to be shifty and demand different evidence than what He's given. We want different evidence. And this is very, for many people, this is a very subtle way of just keeping God at arm's distance all the time. Right? We never have to let Him get close because we are very clever at what evidence we treat as inadmissible. And this is disturbing to me. This is disturbing. I see it in myself. I see it in other people, and I certainly see it in people who are not believers. And what you choose to call evidence, really, that's not a scientific question. That's a metaphysical question. How do you define evidence? as disturbing as that is, I think it gets worse. Even if all the evidence was before us, evidence never compels belief. I'm sort of circling around this whole idea. Evidence by itself never compels belief. In a sense, there's no such thing as compelling evidence. We talk about compelling evidence all the time. You know, we hear that. But there's no such thing as compelling evidence, in that there's no evidence that forces you to believe something. One of the most amazing stories that demonstrates this is of the raising of Lazarus. I'll just read it. So this is John 11. And I'm skipping the middle part of the passage just for the sake of time. But Jesus has heard that his friend Lazarus is very, very sick and dying. When he heard this is starting at verse 4. When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." So he's already viewing this sickness as a way to give a sign to people. He already views the sickness of Lazarus as an opportunity to reveal the truth about who he is, right? Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." This is skipping ahead to verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." Again, this is not just Jesus restoring his friend to life and a brother to sisters. It is that, but it's also a sign. He let Lazarus die so that he could show a sign, which is not just, think about signs and wonders in the Bible. It's not just a wonder. It's a sign, which means it's a pointer to some bigger reality. It's a pointer to ultimately the new heaven and the new earth. It's a pointer to Jesus' identity, right? Sorry, I keep getting worked up here. But I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. "What are we accomplishing?" they asked. "Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation." Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than for the whole nation to perish." He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. So, what's going on in this story? This is one of the clearest demonstrations in the Bible of how evidence, no matter how clear, cannot compel people to believe. It doesn't force anybody to believe anything. When we think about the responses to Jesus' most astonishing miracle, the clearest sign that, in his words, God sent him, his Father sent him, the clearest sign that he himself is God. He's showing himself to be master of life and death. Death is something that's within his control. The clearest demonstration of his divine identity. There's two responses. People either believe in him and follow him, or they dig in their heels and resist him more than ever. So the very same act of power softens some people and hardens other people. The evidence of Jesus' divine identity does nothing except threaten their power. They did not need evidence. They needed to humble themselves. That's what they needed. You think of their first response. This is amazing. To me, it struck me in a new way this time. Jews came to them to tell them what Jesus has done. He just rose a guy from the dead. This guy was dead for 4 days, and he said, come out, and the guy came back to life. And so they call a meeting and say, what are we accomplishing? Right? everything is viewed through a political lens for them. Like, okay, so, yeah, whatever, great. That's great, he did that. So what does this mean for us and our power and the Jewish nation right now and our status before the Romans? You know, it's like, shouldn't they have been asking, what is God accomplishing? What has God done? Another biblical example of evidence not compelling people. this is another fascinating one. Maybe John was particularly drawn to these stories, because this is in John 6, a little earlier in the Gospel of John. This is shortly after the feeding of the either 4,000 or 5,000. I don't remember in John 6. Either way. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, Rabbi, when did you get here? Jesus answered, very truly I tell you, you are looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. So he's saying, you're looking for me because I made bread and you ate. You're not looking to what I did as a sign of who I am and the kingdom that I'm bringing, right? Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him God the Father has placed his seal of approval. Then they asked him, what must we do to do the works God requires? And Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. So they asked him, what sign will you then give, that we may see it and believe you? What will you do? Our ancestors ate manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Again, so that's all. It goes on and on. That's the beginning of a huge discourse in which Jesus refers to himself as the bread from heaven. I'm the manna, actually. But that's just that beginning. The way that whole dialogue begins is just mind-boggling to me, because these people saw him multiply loaves and feed thousands of people, and then they have the gall to say, "Okay, so you're claiming some things about yourself. Are you going to give me a sign so that I can believe you?" They say they want a sign so that they can believe Jesus, but they reserve the right to decide what qualifies as a sign. And feeding the 5,000 the day before just isn't good enough, I guess. Perhaps that evidence of Jesus' identity was inadmissible, right? They didn't allow that into court. But they're still pretending to be fair-minded and open. Or maybe they're just hungry. Show us another sign. I'm not quite convinced yet, right? We don't know. So, lastly, this is still, I'm still sort of talking about sort of a lot of the problems underlying this question. If Christianity was true, wouldn't it be easier to believe it? And I think if we really believe that, if we really believe that anything worth knowing should be easy to learn, and that anything true should be easy to identify as the truth. This will most likely be a decision to drift with whatever the prevailing beliefs of our culture are around us. It'll be a default of just going with the flow, finding the path of least resistance. Because unless I'm willing to actually push hard and discover what is true, then the dominant views of society around me will automatically become what seems obvious to me, right? Whatever appears most plausible and self-evident will be just sort of the whatever I'm imbibing from the world around me. I'm much more likely to be influenced by social pressures than I am by my desire to know what's true. So this is one of the risks in that question, right? I want to move to this last section of just what does the Bible say about this idea of ease in belief? And there's obviously so much to say. And I'm just going to basically offer three main thoughts with some biblical passages to illustrate what I'm getting at, just so you don't think I'm making it all up. So three basic thoughts. The first thought is the Bible teaches that God actually has revealed himself sufficiently for us to believe in him. That's a very foundational biblical theme. You know what you need to know. I've revealed myself. Secondly, we will have to seek after him diligently, maybe with all our strength. The Bible's full of that as well. And then thirdly, faith will be required of us. We will need to have faith. So, going to that first one, the Bible is unambiguous in its claims that God has revealed himself not completely, but sufficiently for us to know him. There are many ways in which God has revealed himself, even if we take just the Bible's account of how God reveals himself. The primary one is in creation itself. So there's the very opening of Psalm 19 is very well known, but it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech." And then it says it's not actually words, but still it functions as speech because it's knowledge of God that we can actually receive by looking around us, if we take the time to look around us and appreciate the beauty and the complexity of creation. And he's just talking about the sky. He's not even talking about, you know, reptiles and amphibians and you know, fungi, other things. Beetles. Paul in Romans 1 picks up this idea. It's a much longer, more complex passage, but he says that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what he has made, so that people are without excuse. So, I don't think he's saying that absolutely everything about God is discernible just by looking at creation, but he's saying these invisible realities, that there is a God of eternal power and divine nature. We are expected to be able to discern that from looking at the amazing things that God has made. Paul is saying there's enough in the created world for people to conclude that there is a God of power. That's creation. But God has also revealed himself using words, using human language. Unbelievably condescending in the good sense. He condescended to speak to us in language. The very opening of I guess you could just say the whole scriptures is an example of that. The fact that there is a Bible for us to look at that was written in a language that can be translated and we can understand. But of course, scripture refers to that reality itself. So in the very opening of the book of Hebrews, it's a wonderful, concise statement of God revealing himself. It says, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. So, just in that first verse, the writer of Hebrews is explaining to us that God really has revealed himself to people. He revealed himself from the very beginning through the words of the prophets. He's telling people, first century audience, to look at their Bibles, look at their Torah. And then, most clearly, in the person of Jesus Christ himself, who is God, who speaks in human language, and who is the Word himself, in a sense, the Word as in the clearest communication of who God is. God himself, a person. You think of Jesus' words in the Gospel of John, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. You know, don't look further to understand what God is like. Look at me. So, some of the ways in which God has revealed himself. Obviously, with Pentecost, the coming of the Holy Spirit that the church just celebrated last Sunday, it's another whole level of God's revelation, in a way in which God is revealing himself still through the Holy Spirit, even now. So, that's just a very imperfect way of saying that in the Bible, the Bible claims that God has revealed himself well enough for us to know what's true. Not comprehensively, because none of us can understand God comprehensively, but enough for us to know what we need to know. The second point is, even though this is true, even though God has revealed himself sufficiently, we're going to have to seek him. The fact that he's revealed himself doesn't mean we are passive and can just sit back and wait to experience God and believe in him. God expects us to apply ourselves because true things are sometimes hard to find. Particularly in a fallen world in which there's lies everywhere we look. True things will be hard to find in the world as it is. They're sometimes hard to find because of our own sin, right? We've just been talking about that most of the evening. True things can be hard to find. The Bible doesn't present or promise a deep, life-giving knowledge of God as a low-hanging fruit, as something that you can just bump into and be like, oh yeah, there it is, great, now I know God. It's something we're told to dig for. If you think of the language about wisdom and about knowing God and all the language about silver and gold, even if you just look at the book of the Proverbs, knowledge of God and wisdom is like silver and gold. It's not just valuable and nice to have in large quantities. The images of something that you seek after with the same kind of zeal and motivation as you would if you were digging for gold. Think of the gold rush. There's a book that my kids got out of the library recently about, like, the gold rush. And there's all this information about all these people just flocking to California because of this chance that they may find some gold, right? Think of the zeal of finding a way from one coast to the other, you know, to look for some gold. You know? Knowledge of God should be like gold and silver to us. Incredibly valuable, but hard to find. You have to strive and dig and mine for it, and it may take all your strength to get it, and it's still worth it. Right? That's what knowing God is, how that's portrayed. It will cost everything you have, actually, but it's completely worth it. It's completely worth your while. And this is very much imagery that Jesus picks up when he compares salvation itself to this pearl. If you're a pearl merchant, you find this pearl. Or if you're digging for treasure in a field and you find a treasure chest full of gold or something like that. Both scenarios, you've been searching for years for something like this, right? The pearl merchant's been waiting for this, a pearl of this quality, you know, or the treasure hunter's been digging for years looking for something. When they find it, they sell everything they have to get it, and it's still worth it, right? It's Like, it's the one thing that if you give everything you have, you still gain. Right? That's what knowledge of God is. That's what knowing God is. So, God evidently doesn't just want us all to have the correct information about him. That's not the height of God's desire for us, that we just have the correct information. He wants us to be people who desire him more than we would desire hidden treasure. So much that we seek after him with all the energy we have. Deuteronomy 4, the book of Deuteronomy is an amazing, amazing book of the Bible. It's very, very rich. And this is Moses speaking to the people of Israel. He says, the Lord, and this is him predicting what will happen when they go into the promised land. They're about to enter the promised land. And Moses is giving them his final words from God. Warnings, reminders, reminders not to forget who rescued them from slavery. And really, I mean, much of the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' kind of vote of no confidence in the people's ability to remain faithful to God, that once they enter the promised land. And he was right. But anyway, this is his prediction in Deuteronomy 4. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples. This is as they're about to enter this, you know, their home, right? The home they've been waiting for. And only a few of you will survive among the nations to which the Lord will drive you. There you will worship man-made gods of wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or eat or smell. But if from there you seek the Lord, your God, you will find him, if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things have happened to you, then in later days you will return to the Lord your God and obey him. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not abandon you or destroy you or forget the covenant with your ancestors, which he confirmed to them by oath. So he predicts to the people that they will not seek God. And as a result, they will worship idols, and the idols that the surrounding nations are worshiping, and they will be sent into exile where there will be more idolatry. But God will still be available to them if they seek him with all their heart and all their soul. I'm still here. But seek me. In other words, if we're going to see God, it takes passion and love and a deep desire to see him. If we are struggling with the feeling that the Christian faith is just too hard to be true, can we honestly say that we have sought God with all of our heart and all of our soul? Because that's a lot, what that implies. Have we really sought after him with all of our heart and all of our soul? Maybe nobody could really say that of themselves. That's why it's such good news that God is merciful. As the text says, as the Deuteronomy passage says. Dick, one of our workers here, has often said something that struck me, that maybe this isn't the exact, correct me if this should be worded differently, but God has not promised to reveal himself to the mildly curious. In other words, there are no rewards promised for passivity. You know, in the Bible, it's not the mildly curious that grow in wisdom and grow in knowledge of God. And there are troubling texts in the Bible. I think of Isaiah 55, and something that's picked up again I guess maybe it originated in Psalm 32, but Isaiah 55 says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will freely pardon." Psalm 32 says, "Therefore," this is after he just reflected on the forgiveness of God, he says, "Therefore let all the faithful pray to you while you may be found." This is a troubling implication here in both of these texts. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Pray to him while he may be found. The implication is that if we blow off seeking God, who has made himself available to us right now, we should not necessarily expect to be able to find him later, when it suits us. It's like the Gillian Welch song, I want to do right, but not right now. It's like, I'm having too much fun right now. I know it's true, but I'm having too much fun right now. I'll get back to it later.
Mm.
God is saying, don't convince yourself that you're going to be able to find me later. I'm here now. Seek me while I may be found. We shouldn't kid ourselves. I don't think so much that this is just a God saying, as punishment, I will not be available to you later. I think very often a way to apply those words is that the longer I turn away from God, the less plausible the truth will become. Right? The further I go down a different path, the more committed I get to that path, and the less believable God's existence will be to me. The harder it will be to repent. The harder it will be to acknowledge that I've been wrong. And I think it's naive to think we can reject God's call repeatedly and still maintain the freedom to say yes to him. Right? When we reject God, we're walking into a narrower and narrower place in terms of what our options are. It's harder to say yes the longer we run from him. And so that God warns us of that. Seek me while I may be found. In Luke 8, verse 10, Jesus explains to his disciples why he speaks in parables. And this is another troubling thing. These are sort of the warnings. This is directly after he has shared the parable of the sower. And the disciples are like, what does that mean? What were you on about? And he says, the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of God has been given to you. So, clearly the parables are providing a rich series of images to his own disciples, to whom he explains the parable. So it's a teaching tool to his own disciples. I think his parables were also a teaching tool to people that didn't get the explanation but walked away and really thought about it. Because parables are these enigmatic stories that demand engagement. And I think there are people who are open to who he was, that went away in the parables and maybe in his questions too, sort of worked on them, you know. But for some, and this is what he gets at later, for some, the people who I think are hardened against him and have no intention of taking him seriously, the parables are judgment. He says, but to others I speak in parables so that though seeing they may not see, though hearing they may not understand. And he's quoting Isaiah 6. Which is where God gives Isaiah his commission to the people of God, and he says, you know, because it's God's judgment on them that they will see but not understand. Now, the third biblical concept here is that faith will actually be required of us. I think we should never expect so much certainty from God that faith becomes unnecessary. Sometimes, without thinking it, I think I really want this. I want such certainty. I want God to show himself so unambiguously to me that trusting him would be superfluous. I wouldn't need to do that anymore. There's a wonderful passage out of the Screwtape Letters, which I will read. Just to be clear, the Screwtape is C.S. Lewis's product of C.S. Lewis's imagination. Screwtape is a demon who's writing to a junior demon his advice about how to mess with a human being, how to lead this human being away from God, how to deceive them, and he's talking about God here as God is his enemy, and so when he says he's referring to the Lord. He says, he really does want to fill the universe with a lot of little loathsome replicas of himself. Creatures whose life on its own miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own. Not because he has absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. We want cattle who can finally become food. He wants servants who can finally become sons. We want to suck in. He wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled. He is full and flows over. Our war aim is a world in which our Father below has drawn all other beings into himself. The enemy wants a world full of beings united to him but still distinct. He's talking about times of spiritual richness and times of spiritual dryness, the troughs, those peaks and troughs in any human's life. And he's saying, and this is where the troughs come in. You must have often wondered why the enemy does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human souls in any degree he chooses and at any moment. But you now see that the irresistible and the indisputable are the two weapons which the very nature of his scheme forbids him to use. Merely to override a human will, as his felt presence in any but the faintest and most mitigated degree would certainly do, would be for him useless. He cannot ravish, he can only woo. For his ignoble idea is to eat the cake and have it. The creatures are to be one with him, but yet themselves. Merely to cancel them or assimilate them will not serve. He is prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of himself, of his presence, which, though faint, seem great to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest over temptation. But he never allows this state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the creatures to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. So anyway, so he's getting Screwtape in his own twisted way is referring to God's desire that we would have faith, right? God's desire that we would actually grow into maturity and not depend for our belief in God on all of the sort of moment by moment assurance. I'm still here. I'm real. I'm still here. I'm real. You know. And of course, God is with us all the time. But his desire is that we would mature to the point of living out what we believe without that kind of moment to moment reassurance from God. And this is the image in Psalm 131, which I really love. It's a very short psalm. I'll just read the whole thing. It says, my heart is not proud, Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have calmed and quieted myself. I am like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child, I am content. Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. The thing I love about this is that it's both a picture of a dependent child, but it's a picture of a dependent child who's maturing. So he doesn't say, I'm like a breastfeeding child at his mother's breast. He's saying, I'm like a weaned child. This is a child who's old enough, who's started to eat solid food and isn't constantly tugging at his mom's blouse to be fed. And so there's this image of maturity and contentment and the ability to stand and accept what's going on around me and not be demanding something from my mom every second. but the psalmist is talking about this in relationship to his knowledge. There's things that are too big for me. There's things that are too great for me to understand. But guess what? I'm okay with that. I'm going to be content like a weaned child. I'm not going to be badgering God for assurance that he's real every 5 seconds. Because I'm weaned. I know that he's real. And part of my responsibility now is to live with that knowledge and try to actually live the life based on that belief. So, I'm just going to conclude here just by, I won't even read the text, but I'll just reflect for a second as an encouragement. I hope it will be an encouragement because this is, there's been some, for me, what have been for me hard things to reflect on. We are not simply evidence collecting machines. We have hearts, we have bodies, we have hopes, fears, desires, memories, emotions, imaginations, all these things go into to what a human being is. we've been spending a lot of time talking about how all that complexity can provide us with endless ways of ignoring evidence and running away from God, right? keeping God at arm's length. However, we can also be drawn to God by all these aspects of who we are. God speaks to us through all these things, through our memory, through our imaginations, through our emotional life, through our memories, through our hopes, through our fears. All of these things can be ways in which we turn to God and find Him. And because of this, I think sometimes we may find we actually need less evidence than we thought we did to believe Him. And this is the story of Thomas, who's gone down in church history as Doubting Thomas, but I think we should call him Believing Thomas. There was a colleague, a LaBrie colleague from a different branch who did a devotional at one of our members' meetings 2 years ago. Wonderful reflection on the story of Thomas who doubted. One of his reflections is, wait a second, he's called Doubting Thomas, but all of them doubted the resurrection when it first happened. He just was absent on that first time that Jesus appeared to his disciples. And so his doubting took place in isolation from the other ones. So he gets the shaft. But he missed Jesus' first appearance. We're not told where he was, but he wasn't there when Jesus appeared to all the other disciples. And he told the other disciples and told himself that he would never believe that Jesus was alive unless he could stick his finger into the wounds, literally touch the wounds. So he set a very high bar for his own belief. You think about the level of evidence he's demanding. It's going to take a lot to convince me. But when Jesus finally does appear to the disciples again, in a very kind and gentle way, he singles Thomas out. He doesn't say, "Where's that jerk Thomas? He didn't believe." No, he looks at Thomas and he singles Thomas out and offers Thomas the very evidence that Thomas says he needs. Right? Do you want to touch my wounds? But in that moment, Thomas finds he does not need as much evidence as he thought he did. He simply worships Jesus and says, "My Lord and my God." One of the insights that this colleague shared was that if you just think about what was going on in Thomas's mind after Jesus appeared to everybody except him, how left behind he would have felt. Am I forgotten? Did Jesus remember me? All of my friends are sort of part of this ongoing story, and I'm back here. Like, what happened? I wasn't there. I missed it. He didn't know if Jesus was going to reappear. Nobody, for all he knew, that was his only chance, right? But the fact that Jesus remembered him and spoke his name turns out to be all he needed to believe with all his heart, right? And so he found himself in this position of not needing the level of convincing he thought he did when in the presence of Jesus, and when really it was him knowing that he was loved and remembered and not forgotten. That's where I'm going to end. And there's a million other things to talk about, obviously, but I'm going to end there. And I would love it if anybody wanted to ask questions or raise objections or offer observations or. And if you need to go, that's fine too. You can leave. But I have a bit more energy, so we'll keep talking for a little longer.
Any thoughts?
Nobody has to ask a question. This is can be bedtime for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just a quick observation. Just the very last thing you just said about Thomas, and that he thought he required, you know, he asked to touch the scars, but he never actually does.
Yeah.
Right? Does he not too?
Yeah.
But what you just said about all I need is Jesus speaking with me. Mm-hmm. It just reminded me of the story of Mary at the tomb.
Yeah.
When the women go to the tomb is empty, and she thinks it's the gardener. And it's the moment he says Mary that she realizes that he speaks her name.
Yeah.
That she realizes who it is. And anyway,
it's not just about them knowing Jesus. It's about the awareness that he knows them.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Richard. Was that a hand?
To follow up Mary Frances's observation. That what Jesus did for Mary of Magdalene was a really amazing thing. I believe that Mary Magdalene, apparently, if I read the way I read the chronology of the scriptures, is that she was by herself there, that the other women were not with her at that point, and so she was absolutely alone there. And all as far as we know of the other former disciples that had scattered, they all had families to go to, or friends that they could be with and, you know, hide out with. But Mary Magdalene, more than anybody else, was committed solely to Jesus. And she had no life other than Jesus. That she had a suspect past. All of her family had probably abandoned her, cast her out, and she had no friends to speak of. And so being around Jesus was her life. And then all of a sudden, her life had been cut off.
Yeah.
And so she was there in, you know, the most bitter disappointment and anguish anybody can imagine. And Jesus is literally on his way from hell to heaven at that point. But he sees his friend Mary there. And says, oh, there's Mary. And she didn't have another friend. Well, okay, I will go myself to comfort her. And so Jesus appears to her, and she doesn't even recognize him. But when she does, her state of consciousness must have been as shocked as a human can be. And yet, of course, she immediately embraced him with a bear hug when she figured out who he was.
Yeah.
And he says, no, you can't hold on to me all this time. I'm going to have to go again, but I've got work for it. And go and tell the other disciples, you must be a witness to the fact that I'm here.
Yeah.
And so, but the fact is that Jesus loved her so much that he recognized that, well, okay, of all the people that Jesus had been with, she didn't have anybody else to comfort her. And so he says, I have no help to send, therefore I must go myself. And therefore he appeared to her as he was on his way on a much grander errand, going from hell into heaven. He stops off to help her. All right, thank you, Mary.
Significant that she's lingering. She's lingering by a grave. Yeah. Everyone else is gone. Thanks. Any other thoughts?
Yeah.
And I really resonated with what you said about creation as a way to, as a revelation. To understand the nature of God by seeing the nature of God.
Yeah.
Michelle and I, we spend our winters in Wales, and there's a spot by our Airbnb that's a 12th century stone chapel overlooking the Irish Sea. And if you go out there on a clear night, you can see the Milky Way galaxy arm reflecting off the ocean, and you can see the curvature of the earth. You can see the coastline of Wales, and it's the one place where I feel my place in the universe, physically feel, and I kind of lose my balance sometimes. And
don't stand by the edge.
Yeah. And the Welsh have a word for when we're away from Wales, we feel this word. It's hiraeth. It's a longing for home that is and was and never was and will be. There's no English translation for it, really. Hiraeth. And so we keep going back. But the world is citifying. We're moving to cities. And we're polluting the air. And we're blocking out the nature of God in all its forms, whether it's cutting down the Amazon or you know, I've been to the Beijing airport and you can't see the other end of it because it's gone.
Yeah.
How do we help people see the nature of God when the nature of God is being destroyed?
Yeah.
And it applies to other pictures. Marriage is being destroyed. Family, fatherhood, there's lots of pictures of God that are being torn apart.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that's real, that there's as we speak, the creation is becoming less diverse. Some species dying and everything. I think there's still beauty and complexity and diversity available to us. I think the problem isn't so, in terms of awakening people's understanding of God through the beauty of what he's made, I don't think the main problem is the fact that we're destroying those beautiful things. That's a huge problem. I think one of the main problems is that just convincing people to look at, to look, because it's there, you know. I don't know if anyone saw the movie Avatar back whenever that movie came out, and there was some chat room afterwards, mostly kind of like single dudes who live with their parents still, like chatting about how like Avatar, the world portrayed in this film, was just so rich and beautiful and complex, and then these creatures and the amazing jungle and all this. Like, I wish we could. You know, basically, the hope that was held out by one of the people chatting, you know, on this chat room was, I can't wait until virtual reality advances to the point where I could go to this place. And I just want to be like, look around you, you know, go walk, I mean, even if you live in a city, go to a park. Look, you know, it doesn't take a thousands of acres of wilderness area untouched by pollution to still see the complexity of what God and the beauty of what God's made. And it's not that I think that we shouldn't be worrying about the impact that humans have on our world. It's a huge crisis. But I do think that there's in a sense, the first step is to awaken people to observe. Wake up and look and see what's right there. I mean, there are things to wonder about, and there's things that would blow our minds if we would just stop and look. And I think Christians, I think in many, not thankfully not everybody, but Christians haven't always been the best people at slowing down and just appreciating the beauty of the physical world that God has made, something in creation. There's the Isaac Watts hymn, sing the mighty power of God. It's this wonderful, it's a creation hymn. He said, I look to the sky. I forget what it is, what the words are, but it's basically there's not a flower or plant below, but makes your glories known. So he's looking at the ground, and then within the same verse, he looks up at the sky and it's like, and it's all there too. And so there's this sense that you can stand on a cliff in Wales and get a sense of the grandeur of the world and your tiny place in it and experience awe at who God is. And then you can investigate a dandelion to a microscopic level and experience awe. Right? There is so much available to us. And the failure to observe and wonder is a spiritual problem. It's not just you're not a nature person, or you're, you know, it's a, yeah. I don't know, it's a huge question. Yeah.
Well, I was just remembering when you were in high school, someone came into the art class and to the science class with some injured birds of prey. I remember you coming home and just, one of the coolest things was all these students who were just kind of jaded and about birds and interested birds, and they were just blown away.
Mm-hmm. They were jaded about life and hadn't even thought about birds.
Right. Yeah. They were blown away by this, the wingspan of this bird in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So filled the classroom. Mm-hmm. And it was, I remember it being quite exciting. We were all excited, like, wow, these kids, these jaded kids, had a glimpse of God's glory. Mm-hmm.
They're sort of shocked into.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Almost despite themselves getting excited about something. It's great.
Yeah.
Part of my excitement was because I was a bird watcher and I was sort of, pretty much a loser for being a bird watcher. And so, like, for that 3 minutes to have, like, something I cared about and be valued by the cool kids was just like, that's right, I liked them before they were cool. Anybody? Yeah.
Your three questions reminded me of something that a man named, I think most of us have heard the name, George Washington Carver. Mm-hmm. He did a lot with the Peanuts, but he mm-hmm. said he was a curious man working at Tuskegee University or Institute mm-hmm. to teach agriculture, and he discovered the peanut as a weed, or he mm-hmm. knew it was a weed. He looked around at various things, and there was one day in his autobiography that he was very frustrated, mm-hmm. and he asked God, why did you make me? And God's answer was, narrow the scope and improve the intent of the question. like, why am I here? And God said, narrow the scope and improve the intent. And so his next question was, well, why am I at this school? God said, well, that's better. try again. Narrow it some more and improve the intent. He said, well, why'd you make the peanut? He said, that I can work with. Let's go to the lab.
See the one that, like, discovered whatever, like, 300 uses for the peanut.
And most people don't know it created industries. Before World War World War II, there were industries based upon wallboard mail or peanut husks. These are fast friends with Henry Ford. Mm. The Ford steering wheel was based upon iron until he replaced it with plastic from soybeans. Mm. Real stuff happened. It wasn't just laboratory stuff.
Yeah.
So I just like that.
Yeah.
That narrow that some of our questions God might be saying, narrow the scope and improve the intent.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
Ben, one of the things you had talked about was God's condescending himself to be able to communicate with us at our level. Mm. And one of the things that comes to mind is a lot of us have experiential knowledge of God, which is kind of odd because it's very subjective. It's not objective. It's relative truth. But just like the hymn, you ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart. And I just find that interesting that God often speaks to the individual where the individual needs to hear. And it's not a blanket umbrella kind of thing for everybody to understand. But it's to the individual, which makes it very subjective. But still, it's God condescending to how you illustrated Thomas, really. Mm-hmm. Thomas needed to know. Thomas mm-hmm. thought he needed to put his fingers in the wounds. Mm-hmm. But he really only needed his name to be called. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that you talk about absolute truth, but often the absolute truth is delivered in such a manner that makes it subjective, because it's the truth that I know because I experienced it. Mm-hmm. It's the truth that I know because it was presented to me the way I needed to understand it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I moments like this, I wish I had a philosophy degree. But I think how we use the word subjective is interesting. Like, on one level, you can use the word subjective to mean basically whatever I feel is true. Nobody can tell me it's not true, kind of thing. Whereas I think what you're describing is it's not subjective in that it's just could be any old thing that I feel inside. It's more. It's personalized. It's actually still the truth, but it's just the truth that was communicated to me personally, which it doesn't mean I have my truth and you have yours. It means you may not be able to understand exactly what I experienced. But it's not a different truth than, you know.
Subjective.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Subjective,
yeah.
Only in that I understand it and I can't convey it to you.
In a way that you would experience
exactly.
It. You know, I was the only one that experienced it. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's so true, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When you look at people who are converted as adults, and the thing that pushed them over the line, there are things that are wildly different from each other, and sometimes completely irrational to somebody else.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's just being loved by someone at a particular moment in their life, which just made everything fit together.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's someone being healed in an unexpected way. Sometimes it's a verse of the Bible striking them in a different way. So in that sense, it's very subjective in terms of what clinches it for you, but the evidence is this vast thing out there. The question is, what of all that evidence is going to get closure through the web of your own sin and autonomy?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, as well, I just think of being able to see God in the natural world. A big problem we face also is that we're taught not to look, but we're taught to see and not notice what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think of the role of macroevolution, the role of a completely secular understanding of the origin of the universe, and how all the tools are there for us to put together what seems like a perfectly rational way of understanding things, the most rational way, scientific way of understanding things. So all these things that might have made someone in the early 19th century gasp and made Christians overinvest in the biodiversity as an argument for God's existence, which was a very foolish thing to do. We fight with a lot of with our culture in terms of getting someone to conclude what they ought to conclude, looking at the natural world,
right.
At biodiversity, the mountains, the amazing wonders, and all.
Yeah.
I think we're being really backward to be inspired in that.
Mm-hmm. But many people who have a completely secular or materialistic understanding of the world still experience something of that wonder. They just don't have a way of explaining it. They don't have a way of legitimizing it.
Yeah, that's beyond what their own explanations ability.
I think it might also be good to remember that humans are part of that creation to wonder at, and so maybe even in the smoggy cities, the experience of the other lowercase o. The experience of the other can also be a very marvelous and confusing thing at which to wonder, and could provide something that those who experience like nature deprivation, which is truly deprivation, but to wonder at your fellow human. It's also like a lens to which we can consider the origin of that being that is also wonderful and frustrating.
It's true. I think many of us maybe have an easier time experiencing something of the wonder of God when we're in creation with not a lot of people around, because people are so complicated and there's always the brokenness entering in. But you're right. But you're right. It's essentially, getting glimpses of the glory of the image of God, in somebody else, which is very often overlaid with all kinds of mess. but that's very true. Dave.
Yeah, I remember I was listening to a podcast about this intellectual that was growing up in the former Soviet Union. Who was an atheist under heavy atheist education, but one time, I think it was his own baby, he just looked at his baby's ear and he's like, there's a creator. For sure. Looking at the ear of a baby, so it's just what it could be for somebody you would never anticipate. You know, mm-hmm. I would never think of, yeah, let's get an argument for the existence of God based on the baby's ear.
Yeah. Let's break it down. Yeah. So,
by the way, when I was in 10th grade, before I was a Christian at all, taking a class in human biology in high school, and I was just blown away by the development of the baby. Just everything we learned in the class. I remember thinking, there's got to be a God. This cannot have been accidental. And just, and then, you know, seeing a newborn baby. But just studying it well before I was a Christian, I just knew that's the only thing that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There has to be a designer. There has to be a God. Mm-hmm.
Then there's the fact that we can think about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. G.K. Chesterton has a wonderful way of saying that. Yeah. I wish I had in my head. I can't paraphrase Chesterton. But he says, yes, the human being himself is absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing to compare with.
The fact that we can wonder at all about
that
anything
like
makes utterly unique and creative. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's true. I think that openness to beauty and complexity and create. I'm not a big intelligent design guy. I don't even really know much about all those arguments. But an openness to experiencing wonder at the complexity of creation. That's precisely the kind of thing I'm talking about when we talk about what evidence is inadmissible and what evidence is admissible. There's For many people who just have a very, very strict sort of materialist view of the world, there's already been a philosophical decision made about what evidence can be is stricken and which evidence is on the table, which then determines what you end up believing. being open to responding to the beauty of something. As being made with intention, as opposed to occurring through millions of random moments of chance, that openness to wonder at that kind of thing is already inadmissible evidence. Right? Any other thoughts?
Well, I just was thinking that I think that's part of what Jesus meant when he said, unless you become like a child, you can't even enter the kingdom of God, much less be great in it. Mm-hmm. That children have that wonder, and they don't need the whole universe to look at. You can, you know, give a child a sandbox or a puddle, or I remember reading sort of memoir autobiography of, her name now, but she's a well-known writer, fine writer, naturalist who taught at Wesleyan University.
Annie Dillard.
She, as a child, just her mother would take her to the library, and she just took out this book over. She's the only person who took it out over and over and over and over again. It was called Stream Life, and she used to just go and find little streams, or and just she just memorized this book, and I mean, it's what got her into the kind of
Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Early
research for the
But it started as a little girl who just took this book out over and over and over again, and would go and look at streams and pick up rocks and look at the life under the rock, and it was really interesting story.
John.
Thinking about the verse, you know, that the heavens declare the glory of God, I think it can be interesting to think about the difference in the sense of the word. Well, like, you hear declare and you think, like, testimony is being given. To think about the difference in the sense of the word testimony or even the word sign, and then the word evidence. And, I mean, I do think that in creation we do have evidence for God's existence. That is to say, I think there are things that you can put into deductive arguments that I think can be successful in that manner. But I think oftentimes people, like Christians, can even get kind of suckered into trying to provide those kinds of arguments, and then maybe if they can't, they feel like they've, you know, that really sort of sets them adrift, or like they feel like they've lost something very, very crucial to their faith or something, if they can't make those arguments work in their own minds or something, or can't make them convincing. But in fact, the experience I think a lot of Christians have when they look out at things in creation is this experience of having received testimony. I think in my own life there was a time when I was very experiencing a lot of doubt with respect to God's existence, and I was praying that I would you know, receive some kind of certainty, you know. And I guess this would be, you know, in the pre-weaned stage, perhaps, which is an important stage, right? But yeah, I was up in some mountains and just kind of looked out at this vista and, you know, the mountains in the distance, and I had this really strong experience looking at the mountains, and I sort of knowing that God existed, and I had sort of tried to believe, looking at the mountains, I tried to believe that God didn't exist, and I couldn't do it, you know. And to me, that was like, actually, that was a big turning point, you know. But it occurs to me that has no place in a deductive argument. It's not. I mean, in one sense, you could call it evidence, depending on how broad you want to use that term, but in one specific sense, you wouldn't call it evidence.
Depends whether you accept the rules of the sort of post-Enlightenment rationalist. I mean, are those the rules that one has to play by? I mean, that's you're talking about deductive arguments. That's already, you know, evidence has already been picked through in terms of what qualifies as a real pointer to God's existence and what doesn't. You know, and if deductive arguments are the only thing that's reliable for discerning what's true or not, then forget about most of human experience. Which is, there's so much more. But more quote-unquote evidence has to be admissible. Including your experience on that, your mountaintop experience. But that was not possibly for you to spell it out in a tight, rational way as to how this proves God's existence, but it was an undeniably real experience. You're still talking about it. So, you know, you're unable in good conscience to just write it off as sentimental or something, you know.
And nobody lives like that across the board. Because I love Lewis's essay on obstinacy. You know, the scientist who's demanding all of that, who's in a good marriage, and somebody questions something about his wife's faithfulness or something, has a whole other criteria for trusting, and it has to do with, we're trusting in a person. And so, like what you're saying, I think you're talking about kind of evidence, which is sort of impersonal. But we're talking about a person who can, and it's a whole other kind of, it's not just believing facts or believing stuff. It's believing in.
It's an I-thou relationship, not an I and you.
And know that it's read that essay. It's a great essay.
Dick in the Dawson,
I think it's another thing that's really interesting to, the snare to me, looking at sort of the history of apologetics, is the idea that what we really want is a universal argument for the existence of God, which means it will convince everybody, or else be able to be, you can show them that they're irrational for rejecting it. Of course, you can't possibly do that on their own terms. Mm-hmm. The people are coming from so many different places. They start with different places. places. The Buddhist would reject anything to do with the material world and the cause and effect rationality. Forget that. That does nothing for me. So the idea of a universal argument, I think Thomas has led us way down the track in a wrong way, and not just him, but those who've tried to make good on the, there's truth in all those arguments, but the idea of a universal proof or set of proofs or something like this is I think utterly naive because of all the things you've been saying tonight, because of how diverse people are and how many different angles you could spin and how different your perspectives are for approaching the thing. But that has led people, when that has failed, I mean, people look at, I remember what Dibigan saying about Descartes attempts to prove God's existence. They ended up being the foundation of French atheism. Because people thought that because they didn't work, then there's no rational reason to believe in God at all. So when we set up a proof that we claim to be a universal proof and it gets shot down, we're giving some people the invitation of saying, okay, well, there's no rational reason to believe it at all, when the argument itself was way out of line in terms of what's possible, given the richness of God's truth, the richness also of human sin, unhappily, and the diversity of it. So I think it's much more helpful, as you have, to deal with it, each individual one at a time, rather than thinking we can have the big universal arguments.
Yeah.
You do have the what I call argument of what? Of this, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows it anyway. The places that so therefore they were without excuse, because they can see the things that do appear. I can't really exact first come from those that still appear. In other words, but you can see the results.
Yes.
So that is an argument there. People reject that.
From Romans 1, I read the part from Psalm 19 and from Romans 1 together, because there were certainly Psalm 19 is more of just sort of like a declaration of the glory of the you know, look around you can see that God made it, and then Romans 1 is much more sort of a challenge. You know, if you look around you and you don't conclude that there's a God, then you're without excuse. So it's much more of a challenging thing that Paul is getting at. But based on the same belief, who knows? He might have been thinking about Psalm 19 when he wrote Romans 1. I don't know. But yeah, David.
The Romans 1 goes a little bit past that.
Yeah.
As much as it says men suppress the truth because of their sin, like a coiled spring, and kind of push it down because they're motive. And atheists will say, well, you know, theists need a crutch. You know? But there's a motive on both sides.
Yeah.
And there's a irresistible drive not to believe in the Creator, to whom they're accountable, who's motive. So, the image that Romans 1 gives us is that the character of God, His eternal attributes and His divine power are clearly seen from the things that He's created. So that everybody can see it, but they don't want to face it. And so, the whole thing about, it's really the sin problem that you mentioned. It's not an evidence problem.
So all the things that we would have to potentially give up to, if we were to accept that it was true. Do you have another question in the back?
Yeah, I just wanted to, everything we've been talking about for the last 5 minutes or so seems to relate to that admissible evidence aspect of things. And I was just wondering if in your studies, Ben, you came to something that helped us maybe to be more adoptive of evidence as opposed to restrictive. I'll give you just for instance. I have a friend who is he sees signs and wonders around every corner, and then there's somebody more like me who's more of a skeptic. So I'm less likely to see God around every corner at every little thing. And so I was just wondering in your studies if you came to some conclusion about how to be more receptive of that admissible evidence.
Not really in my studies for this particular lecture, although what I was getting at in that the whole idea of evidence that's admissible and unadmissible is sort of what's often referred to as scientism. It's not just a belief that science is useful way of understanding the world, which it is. It's an amazing gift of God that we can use to understand the world He's made. But scientism, which is more of really a religious belief, whether it's acknowledged that or not, which basically says the only way we know anything at all is through the tools of science, and therefore only things that we can measure with the tools of science can exist. And so it ends up becoming quite an audacious philosophical claim that itself is unscientific, right? But I think that is just kind of part of the assumption that many people have in the modern West today. And so if it's not measurable by the tools of science, if I can't point to it and measure it and taste it and touch it and analyze it and reproduce it in an experiment, then it's not just, okay, that's beyond the purview of science. It doesn't exist. You know? And that's just a hugely irresponsible religious claim that isn't acknowledged as such. So to me, I think when Christians try to sort of argue for the existence of God, but buying into that this is the way in which we argue, this is the way we prove things, is by playing by the rules that exclude all kinds of things, then we're it's a losing battle. And that's what I'm talking about. No, there's got to be, we have to acknowledge and point out the fact that the evidence that you have discounted, that is not, you didn't discount that evidence as part of a scientific experiment. You just counter that evidence as a philosophical decision before you started doing your science. and we need to be honest about that.
Yeah.
And I'm open to all kinds of different things that are. I mean, Tim Keller talks about less evidence because of all of the implications that word brings up. You know, but he talks pointers, signs, indications that aren't necessarily, and no one of them is a proof of anything, but when taken together and by different people, depending on our experience and what we're open to, really can convince people, you know. And so I want to be very open to that when it comes to. Did you forget your sweater? Yeah. Okay. thanks for coming. when it comes to kind of. Interpreting supernatural things, so seeing supernatural things and interpreting coincidences as being a sign that God is at work and everything, I tend to just temperamentally probably be a little bit more skeptical like you do. Not because I don't think God ever acts in that way. I think He does, but I also think that it become a real temptation to view those kinds of things as the real things that God is doing in the world, as opposed to like look around you at the ordinary thing and be amazed and thank God. And I think some of that, some of the what is associated with more sort of charismatic theology of I think needs interpretation and needs to be weighed scripturally and weighed in church and other things like that. But not because God never acts in those ways, but because we're also prone to see things that maybe aren't God, actually.
Yeah.
Not every strong feeling I have is a sign that God is speaking to me here.
And so I think there's discernment necessary in all those cases, but that doesn't mean a lack of openness. You know, I think God. I think there's something happened here many years ago that really struck me. There was a number of very. It's going to turn the recorder off.